Today, my guest is Dr. Matthew Vijayev. He's the director of National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. Dr. Matthew is an expert ethnobotanist and a researcher. He explains how the climate story and its urgency needs to be balanced with hopeful and creative ideas to inspire positive change. So good morning, Matthew.
Lakshmi, good morning.
Good morning, and welcome to our program.
Thank you. Well, one of the pleasures I've had in my life is to have worked with plants and in a strange way with animals too. And I spent my formative years living in the tropics in Papua New Guinea, where it is, you know, the ideal world for any person interested in natural history. The sheer diversity of the tropical forests is the greatest thrill that any biologist can experience. And some of our greatest biological thinkers, like Charles Darwin, for example, it was his trip to the tropics that opened his eyes to nature back at home. And I think that's one of the most important things, that in our modern world, everybody will say that the world is so fast, they are so wrapped up in living, and the vast majority of human beings now live in cities, and we have become remote from nature. And yet, we are part of nature. We are simply one other creature inhabiting this world of vast complexity. And that has been the pleasure of my life, is looking at that beauty of the diversity of life. And that's how I began my research career in Papua New Guinea, looking at species of plant that had yet to be named by scientists. Local people knew them, they had names for them, but science had not applied a name to them.
Yes, and when science finds it, they usually use a Latin version of it. Do you still do that?
We certainly do. Yes, and some people think, why do you use Latin?
Exactly.
And the answer is, it was once upon a time the language of scholarship across Europe.
Yes.
So if you were an Italian botanist, you would describe your plants in Latin, and a reader in France or Germany or Spain could open it up and they would just read the Latin text and know precisely what you're talking about.
Well, it's connected with their own languages.
It's a beautiful language for a number of reasons. It doesn't have any ambiguity to it. It's probably the best legal language in the world, because every word tells you what part of the sentence it belongs to and how it relates to the other words. So the tenses that the Romans used enabled them to construct a language that was totally unambiguous. And that beauty means that we can transmit information to one another. And I suppose, in a sense, English has become the new global language, but it's an imperialism that's lost the beauty of Latin.
Yes, I think so. Yes, we have to say that. And I suppose we are the powerless, and you can name. It happened in Ireland, isn't it? Naming streets and so
exactly. Yeah. It's a form
from Irish to English. Yes.
In a way, you know, naming something is very important in order for one to talk to other people about it. So you need to put labels on things so as to communicate. But one of the beauteous sort of experiences I had in Papua New Guinea was human languages.
Yes.
There are more than 700 languages in Papua New Guinea, and the island of New Guinea, 1,500 languages. That's one quarter of all the human languages present on Earth. And one would say, why do people speak so many languages? And the answer is that language is not there for communication. It's to stop the neighbors knowing what you're talking about. It's a very interesting insight. And that diversity of languages in New Guinea is reflected in the diversity of biological life there, plants and animals.
Yes, it's to stop the others talking. And also, perhaps owning what they have discovered.
The way that
ownership. Probably.
Yes, it is partly that it's an ownership thing, but it's also a communication thing. I mean, if one goes to a sort of Genesis story where Adam is naming everything, yes, there is a sort of an imperialism about that of wanting to own something by naming it. But it's how we communicate, and I think one of the greatest losses that we make in, say, modern Ireland is that children do not know the names of plants and animals like they used to. And yet, you know, all these little birds that inhabit the back gardens of every house in Dublin are phenomenal creatures. The colour and the beauty of them, if you're not able to talk about them, really you can't empathise with them.
Yes.
And so it's important to be able to transmit to children a love of nature, because otherwise the very origin of the human race, we came from the biological world, and if we don't look after it, it will be lost.
Yes. You know, I was just thinking it should start with the children, and if the parents know about it, then they could transmit it to the children. And also, I've been watching some programs about the Amazon just recently.
Yeah.
And you could see the forest dwellers, they actually, the children go and look for things, you know, for food, for berries, even catch fish. And also, they're not afraid of a three-year-old child can have a knife or a machete.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Did you find that in...
Run around, absolutely.
Yes.
I think, you know, all children should learn how to play with sharp knives,
yes,
with matches, with dangerous things, because that's how you learn. We learn, all of us learn by our mistakes. And little children cut themselves on big knives, but having done it once or twice, they become very adept at not cutting themselves. It's the same when you learn how to use an iron for the first time. Very dangerous thing. But one small burn and... Ow, you remember that, and it's taught you something.
Do you think, like when you were in Papua New Guinea, did you see, because you saw forest dwelling people as well there? Did
yes.
you? Yes. And how do they teach their children to kind of familiarize themselves with the forest?
By exploring, and that's how every child learns. Really, it's self-discovery. And I think that's the most important thing, to have time to spend looking at nature and playing with it. I mean, my own personal upbringing would have been in summer holidays on the beach, in rock pools, catching little creatures, looking at things close up. The diversity of life in a rock pool is so informative, because it is a lesson in self-discovery.
Yes.
Finding something. What is it? You can ask your parents, they say, I don't know. And so you've got to then go to books and, you know, having nice little sets of illustrated guides to learn about what the little building blocks of nature are is one of the greatest education opportunities. And studying natural history at school is an important way to enable children to familiarize themselves with the world, to understand how all of these things work together, because it's incredibly complicated, the world. And us botanists, biologists who have studied it for lifetimes, we all know we're only scraping the surface. There is so much yet to learn about it. And I suppose the thing that saddens us all so much, as if you can imagine sad scientists, is the thought that so much of this will disappear before people have had a chance to understand it and learn about it.
You were saying how important for children to learn about things, isn't it? And I suppose by educating children, we can have a better future in the environment. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and I think one thing that I would always be anxious about is not creating worry for children, anxiety. I think any child watching television, natural history programs, yes, they'll see the program and then they'll be told towards the end, you know, how climate change, how forest destruction, how pollution are destroying these things. And it can be very upsetting, to the point where...
Anxiety.
Exactly. And anxiety builds up to the point where you feel there's nothing I can do about it. But actually, there's a huge amount all of us can do.
I think it generates inactivity.
Yes.
Because we can't do anything. Yes.
Things seem so large and impossible to cope with. But if you decide personally, you know, I'm not going to have a product that uses palm oil, or I am not going to eat, you know, huge quantities of meat, these are things that will have an effect. If 7 billion people choose to do one tiny little thing, 7 billion little things build up into something gigantic.
Yes, yes. That's what we need to think, that we are interconnected.
Yes.
That if I do something, that it has a power to, you know, go, how do you say it? It's a whole community will be doing it.
One of the things that we have to learn is about how every little action we do or thing we consume, it has an effect on the entire world. There's a lovely expression that, you know, tugging a tiny little thread in nature, the whole world moves because everything is interconnected. And there are some wonderful examples of how there is an intricate relationship between insects, plants, trees, mammals. And these interconnections exemplify what one sees manifest in a tropical rainforest. That a tropical rainforest has got this phenomenal diversity. Probably more than a third of all the species on this planet live in tropical rainforests, which only occupy a tiny fraction of the Earth's surface. But they have a diversity that is mind-boggling.
And it lets us breathe, I suppose, all these rainforests.
Well, all plants on Earth produce oxygen. And actually, the biggest source of oxygen on this planet is from phytoplankton in the oceans, tiny planktonic algae that produce, you know, a vast quantity of oxygen. But trees, without doubt, have a major role in that. So the big tropical rainforests of this world are major producers of oxygen, but more so, they are major consumers of carbon dioxide, which is the big bogeyman of today, that there is too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now. And we need the plants, the vegetation, the algae of the oceans to try and suck that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere again.
So if they are polluted, if the oceans are polluted and the rainforest is cut down, we are not able to breathe good oxygen.
In a way, it's the life support system of the globe. And instead of looking after it, if we sat on an ocean liner or in a spaceship and we started interfering with the life support systems, you know, everyone would say, hoi, stop that. You know, don't damage that. We all rely upon it. But for some reason, we in our modern world have become so remote from nature. We're quite ignorant of consuming stuff and not realizing that this is our life support system and we must not damage that is so important to us.
I think people are so stressed nowadays because, you see, for financial reasons and taking time to think about things. It's difficult. Do you not think so?
It is. And more importantly is to think in a cheerful way about it. I think just trying to dwell upon the horrors of, you know, what we've already done to date with microplastics or carbon dioxide levels is not a solution to the problem. The solution, in a way, is a love of nature. It's sometimes termed biophilia. And biophilia is something that all of us humans experience. If you are sat on a nice warm bank of grass looking at a river or a waterfall with a fantastic view across forest in front of you, your heart rate drops, you feel relaxed, calm, stress disappears. And in fact, some scientists think, well, perhaps this was a deliberate ploy of early human beings. Evolutionarily, you felt that because predators couldn't creep up on you. If you can see the view, if you have a nice spot near a water source, you know, you've got supplies of water, food, and no predators sneaking up on you, of course you feel relaxed. So in a way, perhaps early human beings had that very notion of appreciating the moments that they could relax. Most animals on this earth live in constant expectation of either being eaten or trying to catch something to eat. And yet us human beings have reached a point through our extraordinary intellects to have a means to produce a surplus of food so we can sit down, we can talk, we can communicate, we can pass on knowledge. And that has given us an extraordinarily fresh view of appreciating the nature from which we have come. So evolution has produced something at last that can appreciate the whole beauty of the universe. But if you absent yourself or divorce yourself from nature, then you don't appreciate how important it is. You've forgotten. And I think that is what has happened to us as a crowd of organisms. We have forgotten the nature we came from because we started to live in cities so much.
And also it's built up. I think even nature is being built up now, isn't it?
Yes.
Because it's been the deforestation and even market economy has built the environment to suit the people who has power.
And I think the great danger is the market economy, like you say. For example, the criticism that has been levelled towards Brazil because of forest fires is quite extraordinary in a way. The people we should be criticising are the big oil producers. We should be saying to Saudi Arabia, stop drilling for oil and stop exporting it. Now, of course, that sounds rather revolutionary. You think, oh, you can't say that. We need it. But actually, it is the greatest danger to the human race is that we go on drilling out this oil and burning it.
Yes.
And in a way, we should stop it. And again, another effect, for example, of the trade war currently between North America and China is that China now needs to obtain soybeans from South America. They need the forest cleared. They need more agricultural land in Brazil to produce protein vegetables to feed to animals. Your battle should be completely reversed there. You say, if we have a trade war, it will lead to environmental destruction and degradation. The one thing we ought to be doing is everything in concert in order to build a globe that can start to reduce its footprint, its carbon footprint.
So everybody must think politically or socially or whatever way to be sustainable so that we live together in this planet.
Yes, competition, I suppose, is the extraordinary thing. We have evolved because of competition. Natural selection means that the most aggressive, most fast reproducing organisms survive to the detriment of the slowest reproducing or the least aggressive species on this planet. So humanity, in an extraordinary way, is both the pinnacle of evolution, but also its nemesis. It has evolved, if you like, a species, Homo sapiens, who is hell-bent on destroying the globe. And it's a tragedy that we can't unthink ourselves or separate ourselves from this avaricious nature that is in us. I think there's a wonderful example of this of two little peas. If you take a little pot of compost, so just imagine this as a little thought experiment. Take a little pot of compost and you sow a pea in it. That pea will grow into a pea plant and it will flower, set pods, and produce a crop of peas. Now, if you take twice that amount of compost in a little bigger pot and you sow two peas together, something very different happens. Within a few days of germination, 4 or 5 days after germinating, those two peas become aware of one another. Their roots have touched, and the two peas suddenly realize they are in competition with something that is very, very similar to themselves, i.e. it's another pea. It'll want the same minerals out of that soil. Those two peas now start to produce huge quantities of roots, almost twice as many roots as a pea growing on its own in a pot. And this competition for roots is to do with making sure that they have a supply of minerals they need, but to the detriment of their leaf growth, to their flowering ability. They produce fewer flowers, they set smaller pods with smaller seeds and fewer seeds. So the net crop of those two plants is less than if they'd been grown separately in different pots. And this is often referred to by scientists as the tragedy of the commons. If we have something in common, for example, if behind your house you have a little patch of woodland and you and all your neighbours are told you can go in there and harvest firewood. Every morning you can go and collect the firewood that you need. Well, then some people might say, well, if I get up a little bit earlier than Lakshmi, I will get more wood faster. So essentially everybody gets into competition with one another and they start to overexploit that little patch of woodland. And suddenly you can look back in a few years and realize you have destroyed it. You've harvested all the timber out of it and there's none left. And so unless you were all to sit down at the beginning and say, right, we must be very careful with this resource, we must look after it and guard it so that it produces timber forever, because it should do. It should sit in the sun every day, building carbon dioxide, building wood that we can then burn on our fires and cook our food with.
Normally, from my experience in living in the tropics, usually women go looking for firewood.
Yes.
And they go in groups, and they are very... You know, they are friends, they are relations, and with their children they might go and find firewood. This is in the old times probably. But it's a community, and there's less competition.
Yes.
But now there's more competition probably.
And when it breaks down is because suddenly a neighbouring town says, we will pay you
yes.
money for this timber. So suddenly everyone says, aha, you know, if I could harvest enough so as to get money for it, I will be able to buy myself a radio or some other little trinket that perhaps will give me some pleasure. But the more people that start to supply the timber, so the price will start to drop. So people need to start collecting more timber. Mm. And this is what builds this terrible cycle of over-exploitation. Mm. And we do it wherever, as a human race, we do it, whether it's fishing in the oceans, harvesting trees, and we don't realize that the trees and the forests are actually vital for filtering rainwater so that we have drinking water, cooling the atmosphere. If you chop down forest, you no longer get the cooling effect of this evaporation of water vapor above, which generates clouds. So actually, clouds in the tropics are built by forest. If you don't have forest, if you have hot open soil or grassland, the temperatures above that are so high, clouds don't form. Mm. So there is a terrible cycle of destruction that can be wrought unless you think carefully.